from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to learn about herbs and spices on vegetables that can increase their appeal to men, especially young men and young adults. New research, University of Illinois at Urbana. Also, the emerging view of aging, that it's reversible, that it's an epigenetic process. This comes from the National University of La Plata in Argentina, and it aligns with what my entire adult life's work has been about, that we do have solutions that can help you reverse. And how much? You won't believe how much you could actually de-age. I'll let you know in about 5 minutes. Also from Green Med Info, CRG, one of the best sources, most quality sources, reputable sources for good information, we find that chemotherapy fails, entirely fails. And yet look at something like flaxseed. Wow, I'll share some insights that you haven't heard before. Also, it's Lyme disease time. Almost everyone knows someone who has it. Well, not to despair. There's a lot we can do if we know the real facts. Natural health is helping us. We're going to separate the facts from the myths about Lyme's disease today and a lot more. And for the children who are not allowed out to play because there's either no equipment or no playground, it's not helping the children. I'll explain why it matters that poor kids don't have time to play from talk poverty. And also for all the veterans out there, or people you may know who are veteran who are having a rough time, Natural Blaze has found that veterans find therapy in farming. That's good. And I'll give you some insights into that as well. From our environmental segment today, a commentary from Andrea Levchek from Counterpunch on Indonesia's Borneo is finished. They also sell orangutans into the Select Savory. Who would have known any of this? Most people wouldn't even know where Borneo is. It's the third largest island in the world, and that it's in Malaysia. But it's polluted beyond redemption. I'll talk about what I'm concerned about with our environmental groups and the Paris Accords on climate. Also, I'm going to talk on our social issues issue about what's going on in Yemen. Now, why is this important? Because we, the United States, which means we, the taxpayers, are paying to have the military-industrial complex outsourced to private contractors, planes and cluster bombs that are being used by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain and other league groups to bomb Yemen. Now, Yemen is the poorest of all the Middle Eastern countries. It's a basket case. So we have a direct moral responsibility for the death and destruction to all the citizens there. The newest information from the UN News, cholera cases in Yemen reach 130,000 in just 2 weeks. Most of those cholera cases are children. Most will die. So, with about 70,000 cholera cases reported and 600 fatalities, then you're looking at least 100,000 potential dead children. That's on us, Saudi Arabia, who has no shame, nor any of the other countries that support the terrorist activities or hegemony, but it's also the United States government and Donald Trump. So I'm going to talk about that. Also, the melting Arctic, which I've been discussing, awaits a nitrous oxide release. And this is from mainstream Climate News Network. So we're going to talk about that. Medical error. Half of all breast cancer patients mistakenly told to get a mastectomy when they don't need it. From Natural Health. When you realize how many women each year are getting mastectomies that didn't need it, wow. And over the weekend, there was the Left Forum. I've been one of the presenters at the Left Forum. I certainly support it. It's important for people who have a clear knowledge of the problems of our society who are generally not invited on most of the media because they're considered too radical, their ideas. But it's important to get together and to share ideas. Sometimes you'll agree, other times you disagree, but at least you're having a point to where you can decide, this is a problem, what can we do about it? I believe that we need to go back in time, back past the 1960s, past the 1860s. Let's go back, way back, to the 1700s. Today, a short commentary on why we need today Thomas Paine. Today, he would be considered one of the most progressive minds on the planet. He certainly was then. And we're going to hear from John Scales Avery from Countercurrents on why we need him today and why they needed him then and all the things he did that you may not be aware of. I don't know if we'll have time today, but if we do, I'm going to share an audio clip about autism. And this is a part of a series that I'm going to be doing, showing you what really causes autism and hearing from people who have to live with it every day, and they're fighting back. There are not a few dozen or a few hundred or a few thousand. There are millions. So they're unifying, they're getting information, and they're now bringing their case to the media, and the media doesn't want to hear it. The media always brings in these talking heads to refute them. You'll hear one of these today. And the inconvenient truth about the Democratic Party. If you've experienced anything that is pathetic in the last week, one of them was Hillary Clinton blaming the Democratic, the entire Democratic group for her failure. Boy, is she on the wrong side of this. She takes no responsibility for the fact that people don't like her, that she had been supportive of the problems that are endemic within the minority communities. She and her husband caused lulls and then public persuasion to see that more people went to jail, mainly people of color, disrupting families, destroying families, having children who have one or both parents in prison and frequently end up in orphanages or run by the state, and those are never good. And she took no responsibility for this, taking people who needed welfare and taking them off. When she talks about being a feminist, exactly what kind of feminist are you? You're certainly not standing up and did not stand up when you were the co-president and when you were Secretary of State for all the women who were subjugated to abuse around the world by regimes that your foundation was receiving money from. So we're going to hear about why we need a new movement in America, an independent movement, aside from the Democratic Party, which is irreversibly corrupted. I'll share some thoughts on that. Again, I'm not sure I will be able to get to all those, but we'll get to as much as possible. I want to start with something that impacts all of us, aging, because we're all aging. We are all going to age. We are all going to one day realize that we're experiencing our second childhood, but not in a good way. When you have to change the diapers of your parents, when you have to hand feed them, It's a crisis of unimaginable suffering. The caregivers die faster than any other group. In fact, that's one of the reasons that a lot of psychologists, psychiatrists, physicians, they take on the energy of the person they're working with, understandably. But in the process of doing that, they can't separate out that patient's suffering and energy from being a sponge for it. Now imagine being a daughter, a husband, a wife, and suddenly your mom, someone you love, is suffering. You got to be there for them. It's the moral thing to do. But we don't know how to do it. We're not prepared to do it. Even last night, I'm walking up the street, and a man stops me on the street, and he says that he's a real estate broker, and he starts asking me my thoughts about the real estate market. And I tell him why I believe that the market is going to crash, and why, if you did the math, I said, you're a broker. How long have you been a broker? 30 years. I said, how many high-end buildings are being built where the price starts at $10 million or up? And he said, probably over 50 in Manhattan alone. I said, over 90. I said, add a total number of apartments, how many billionaires are there or very rich people who could afford those? They're under 2,000. So if you got 2,000 of the world's wealthiest people could afford this without blinking an eye, and they're holding off or have already purchased stuff, then who's going to fill these? Anyway, I had this whole discussion about the myth of continuous growth and continuous inflating the bubble until it collapses on you. And then he asked me, he says, you know, my mom is 93. She has Alzheimer's. Sometimes I can see in her eyes she recognizes me. I can see it. And she'll hold my hand. And I know that my mom's connecting with me, though she can't speak. And I said, what are you doing? Well, there's nothing you can do. I said, oh, there's a lot you can do. And you may even be able to reverse some of that brain aging so that your mom will not only recognize you, but be able to recognize you and speak. He said, really? Well, I've been spending all this money with the so-called best neurologist and the best, you know, people in the field. I said, well, the fact that they're considered the best doesn't mean that they have the answers, just that they're the most respected in a given field. That doesn't mean that they are right. So I gave him a protocol. He wrote it down on the street. My hope is that he uses it and his mom improves. I've seen a lot of people reverse brain aging to measures and degrees, and some completely. So that's where we begin this little journey, and that is that the National University of La Plata in Argentina did some research. And in geriatrics and gerontology, and what they said is, quote, the achievement of their research is to see whether or not you can impact aging, and it's based upon epigenetics, meaning everything we've been exposed to in our life, everything, conscious and unconscious, when we could understand it, when we were kids and infants and babies, toddlers, and could not understand it, it still impacts us. And so what they've come to a decision is that an adult somatic nucleus was able to be impacted. Now, in lay language, what this means, I'll keep it just very simple. It means that we can create new chemistry for the brain. There's a tremendous amount of plasticity to the brain that we never appreciated before, that you can grow new cells. You can create new dendrites. Just visualize a telephone pole. You have two poles, and between the poles is a line. That line is the dendrite. Then you have what are called synoptic junctions, where information is stored and transferred. So when you drink alcohol, you snap those lines. When you eat fried food, you snap those lines. When you have some of that stuff you see on those cooking shows, like last night there was a cooking show, a cook-off championship among barbecue, and it showed how they all, you know, grilled their, you know, their pulled pork and their ribs and their briskets, and it cooked for, you know, 13 hours at high temperatures and put all this on it so someone could eat it and say, this is good. Well, it's not good for you. There's not a single part of your body it's good for. It's bad for your colon, increases colon cancer, bad for your breasts, increases breast cancer, bad for your ovaries, can create ovarian cancer. It's bad for the brain. It causes inflammation, can lay down plaque. Now, the question is, can we reverse plaque in the brain? The answer is unequivocally, absolutely, yes. But you can't do it haphazardly, piecemeal. You must give yourself time and a protocol to do it correctly. Now, I'm not going to do it today because it would take me 2 hours. But in the very near future, I'm going to do a webinar just on reversing brain aging naturally. I'm talking about Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, multiple sclerosis, even memory loss, dementia, depression, and anxiety, all in one evening. But not today. But can you do it? Yes, we've done it multiple times. And that's what they're saying here. That the epigenetic, epi meaning larger genetic, our genes, meaning the environment, the larger environment to which you are exposing your genes, the words, the way words are said, the tone in which they're said, the smells that you encounter, the sounds you encounter, the feelings that you encounter, having someone hold your hand, petting a pet, when your dog is being petted, you're creating a hormone, the love hormone, and that's why your dog or cat loves to be petted, but so do you. Hugs are important. A real hug where you're not just doing something cursory, but you're doing it because you really want to express the energy you feel for another human being. That hug is important. But depending upon how you were raised, maybe you weren't raised with hugs. Maybe you weren't raised where someone gave you head massages. Maybe you weren't raised where you could just spend whatever time you wanted just, you know, going barefoot in nature and enjoying the feel of the ground under your feet. All this impacts us. Every single thing we experience in life impacts us. And then one day, you wake up and you become the total sum of everything you've experienced, good and not so good. It's not all black and white. It's not all that we've had, you know, been victimized or that we've been rewarded. Everything in life is based upon what is my perception this moment? How do I feel? What is the input? How's it impacting me? Do I like it? Do I do not like it? Can it help me or not help me? Because some of the things we learn to like are actually bad for us. One of the reasons that people drink alcohol, smoke marijuana, take opiates, is not just to relieve pain, because they're not very good for that, but it creates an altered state of awareness. You simply feel less pain. So instead of saying what's wrong with this drug, which is what we do, it destroys your life, look at this addictive behavior you had of gambling, you know, you put your family at risk, you gambled away, you know, your bank account and your home. Didn't you think? Weren't you thinking? That doesn't work. Trying to shame someone doesn't work. Why don't you ask a different question? Why don't you ask, what was good about your addiction? What did you gain from it? What was so powerful and so positive you continued to sacrifice everything in life to go back to it? Because we never think of something that's that bad in its outcome as being that good as to why we would select it. And working with addicts as I have my whole life, thousands upon thousands, I was a head of addiction at the Institute of Applied Biology working with Trafalgar Hospital, so I work with a lot of addicts. A, I don't believe addiction is a disease. I believe that's just another way of marketing it for profit by commodifying it and commercializing it. And B, I believe that we never look at the full picture. And if you don't see the full picture, how can you ever solve a problem? So if you look at addiction as a choice that is made because it's doing something that nothing else in that moment will do, and that person wants that choice reinforced over and over again until possibly they kill themselves with it, like a drug overdose, or get everything lost. So we got to look at something from its more holistic point of view. Then you can do the same thing with aging. If I don't like my sagging skin, if I don't like my gray hair, if I don't like my broken nails, if I don't like my musculature being, you know, weak and infirm, if I don't like all these illnesses, if I don't like being in a wheelchair, if I don't like having arthritis, high blood pressure, prostate enlargement, if I don't like not being able to sleep at night, if I don't like forgetting people's names, including people I know, then what am I doing that continues to contribute to it? And what am I doing to try to slow it down or reverse it? That is where epigenetics comes in, because it's looking at the totality of everything you've been exposed to. Now, we can't simply say, okay, now I'm aware of what I did, so that changes it. No, it does not. An awareness of a problem does not correct a problem. The awareness of history merely gives us context to whether or not we're doing something in a balanced or imbalanced way today. So once I become aware of everything that can create premature aging, then I can stop doing it. I can stop inflammation by getting rid of the French fries, hot dogs, hamburgers, pizzas, the meat, the dairy, the sugars, the processed foods, the caffeine, the alcohol, the smoking. I can get rid of it. But that still doesn't repair the damage that's been done. That's the big thing, because people say, well, you know, Gary, I stopped drinking, you know, 20 years ago. Why do I have cirrhosis of the liver? Because you didn't repair the liver. Make it real simple. And I had to do this yesterday for someone. I says, you're just not understanding what I'm saying. The fact you've stopped a bad habit doesn't mean that it should correct itself. Let me just put it this way. You go into your house, you take a sledgehammer, and you pound a giant hole in your floor. Now you get a hole in the floor. You can look down, you see the apartment below you. Now you realize, well, why did I do that? Well, I was angry. Okay, so you got all that why I did something stupid. Okay, now you're not going to knock another hole. That's good. But you still got a hole. You say, well, I don't know how to deal with it. Don't want to deal with it. Don't have the time to deal with it. I got too many responsibilities. Well, that's part of the reason you did the stupid hole thing, because you're so frustrated you didn't know where to put your angst. And so you put it into some inanimate object, that floor. Now you got a hole, so you throw a rug on it. So that's what we love to do in America. God, we're great at that. Why solve any problem when we can disguise it, deny it, avoid it, or hide it? As long as you're willing to hide a problem, you don't have to worry about it today. I'll get to it tomorrow, next week, next year. No, you won't. Who are you kidding? Look in the mirror and ask yourself, when was the last time you were honest with yourself? If you're not honest with yourself, you're going to be perpetually sharing that dishonesty with other people. So then we put two carpets on the hole. I put two layers, denial and avoidance. That's going to keep someone. And then one day you're standing in that rug, forgetting you're there, and it starts sinking. And now the rug is going through the hole and you're going through it with it. So that's what I see every single day in my life, every single day, from PhDs and Nobel Prize winners. I don't care the degree of education. In fact, the irony of it is the smarter someone is, the more difficult it is for them to change. In fact, I rarely see anyone who's more advanced in their careers change anything because they've invested so much into getting what they have and holding on to it. So the epigenetics says, okay, now we understand what caused the hole. Let's repair it. That's anti-aging. That's when you can actually reverse brain aging, reverse muscle loss, reverse the depletion of energy in the mitochondria and get your energy back. So the good news is that based upon what we now know about immature cells, that we can stem cells, that we can rejuvenate tissue, we can rebuild those dendrites, we can put our life back together again. It's all doable. So if you are looking at the problem and thinking, I can do is adapt to it. I got to get another medication. I got to get a pain medication. No, you don't. You can literally rejuvenate. Now, the fact your doctor may not be aware of that doesn't mean that it's not doable. From the University of Illinois, they're talking about herbs and spices on vegetables, making it more interesting. Adults who don't routinely eat vegetables for lunch may be more likely to consume them if the vegetables are seasoned. Well, this is just common sense. And yeah, when people say, well, I don't like broccoli. Remember George Bush Sr.? I don't like broccoli. Well, you don't like peace either. You must have had your son who became our president through some form of immaculate rectal consummation of some spiritual attainment to neoconservatism, because there's just no matter in that brain. He didn't have to worry about having a stroke. But there he is, not liking broccoli. Well, did you ever think about sautéing the broccoli? Maybe sautéing it with some shallots? Maybe sautéing it with some white beans and putting a tomato sauce on it? Suddenly, you're tasting all those things along with the broccoli and getting all those good isothiocyanates and healthy nutrients to prevent cancer. So this is what they found in the study, that you were 150% more likely to select vegetables if they had a seasoning on them. Now, salt and pepper, in my opinion, are not a seasoning. If you want to season them, you know, use lime juice. If you took lime juice and mixed it with some manuka honey and pasted it on, you just wipe with a little basting brush, wipe the lime juice with manuka honey and some coriander if you like something exotic, or tarragon if you want something that's more zesty, and you wipe that across your vegetables. Delicious. And really no extra cost. So broccoli, carrots, green beans that were chosen for this study, when they seasoned them, people ate them. And now from the Lund University, which is in Sweden, the association between sucrose, which is your white table sugar, and acute coronary events risk and the effect of modification by lifestyle. So the investigators discussed new findings in health and medicine and diet and nutrition. And according to what they found, quote, previous studies have suggested a high intake of sugar-sweetened beverages is positively associated with the risk of coronary event. That's a heart attack. However, a few studies have examined the association between sucrose, the most commonly used sugar, and incidence of coronary events. And what they found was the more sugar you take, the more likely you are to have a heart attack. And they looked at 26,190 individuals. So what can you do? That's the bad news. What you can do, stop the sugar and start increasing vegetables and fruits. A tremendous increase when they and an increase in health and a decrease in heart disease, heart events, coronary events, when they got rid of the sugar. In fact, in some cases, it was almost complete. So the more fruits and vegetables you eat, the less likely you are to have a heart attack or a stroke. And finally, a failing chemotherapy paradigm looks to flaxseed for help. A new study published in the International Journal of Oncology illustrates an important shift occurring in medical research today, namely, a growing recognition that conventional treatments like chemotherapy, taken alone, are failing to produce positive results, and that the use of natural substances may be an indispensable way to improve outcomes. In the study titled Combining a Chemotherapy with a Phenolic Extract from Flaxseed Oil, Evaluation of the Effect of Two Breast Cancer Cell Lines, Italian researchers sought to evaluate the possible synergistic role of an extract of flaxseed in combination with conventional chemo drug in a number of breast cancer cell lines. They also noted that a commonly used cancer drug is notorious for its side effects and that it's very destructive. And what they found was that, quote, eating flaxseed may reduce breast cancer mortality by up to 70%. This is by itself, by the way. And flaxseed can prevent and kill breast cancer cells in a meta-analysis, meaning multiple studies show this. And flaxseed may be a potent ovarian cancer killer, killing the cells that create ovarian cancer, by itself. We're not talking about chemotherapy. Just having the flaxseed by itself each day can kill cancer of the breast, kill cancer of the ovaries. And it also helps with prostate cancer as well. And, quote, flaxseed contains estrogens that regress cancer. So what we're having is overdiagnosis and overtreatment of breast cancer. And now we're seeing that something as simple as flaxseed can make a difference. That's the latest on health and nutrition. We're almost halfway through the program here. While we're at it, just a few of the things that are important on this topic of health, mental health, for all the veterans. If you get into gardening, it can help relieve post-traumatic stress disorder in a big way. And this is the latest study on the topic. And it reduces the likelihood of suicide. And 22 to 23 veterans every single 24 hours are killing themselves, generally shooting themselves. So we want to stop that. And so my suggestion is this, because we're heard all over the world and every day. And for those living in the United States, at least, there are many different farms, small organic farms. And why don't you reach out to some of the organic farming organizations and see about having them post jobs that would be available, paying jobs, you get paid, to work on an organic farm. And I will reach out today, and I'll ask Ronnie Cummins, who's one of the leaders of the organic farm movement in America, about making an internet posting of which farms and which states and the contact information for that farmer, so that vets, and this is just for vets I'm talking about today, who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, can go there and work and earn some money, live in a beautiful environment, a natural environment, be around vegetables and orchards, whatever's there, and get their hands in the soil and get back to nature, because nature helps heal. The energy of nature is very healing, very soothing. It's very calming. So I'll start posting these on GaryNull.com and ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com as well. And we'll try to get some work. And I've got some farming projects myself coming up, not now, but a little later. And I'll see about putting a posting up, so I'll interview for that as well, or the person who's actually going to manage the hydroponic project. I'll see that we can hire some vets, give them a good place to live, give them a salary, and hopefully get them back to where they are able to regain a sense of completeness of what was affected. And that reminds me of something. Someone yesterday made a comment in the park. We were running. And says, well, I'm not really concerned about how militarized the police are or how, you know, how much of a police state we have, because I know that the American soldier would never fire upon American citizens. And I said, and by what is the measure that you have that confidence? The person said, well, they're human beings. I said, yes. And go throughout history and look at Mao Zedong. Look at Pol Pot and the killing fields in Cambodia, 2.5 million killed. Look at Stalin and the purges. Look at the destruction of the Ukraine back in the 1930s. Look at Hitler. Do you really believe that every German that wore uniform would stop before they executed someone, say, look, I'm just a human being, you're a human being, I shouldn't be killing you? It didn't stop anyone from killing people. And I said, and look at Vietnam. Look at Afghanistan. Look at the drone pilots killing people without even knowing that they're guilty of anything. And I said, we've been nonstop about what happened in London, which was terrible, the terrorist attack with the guys with the knives and the guy with driving in the truck, the van, to kill people. And that made headlines around the world. Did you see a single headline about the 120-plus people killed in Afghanistan, mainly women and children? Are their lives any less of value? All lives are valuable. And yet it gets no attention because we don't value them the same. I said, so just remember, here's the difference. When you go into the armed forces, man or woman, doesn't matter, you have to go through combat training. You have to go through boot camp. And there's where the drill sergeants, through a very tried and true method, dehumanize you. It'd be no different if you went to a boot camp where in that, you know, 3-month boot camp, they had to train you to do things without fear, without thinking, to respond immediately. So after 3 months of being told that you obey orders, that you're a nobody, that you're less than a nobody, and that you're only a somebody if you do what you're supposed to do, and that the higher-ups, the people who make the decisions what to do, are wise enough to do it right. And so by the time you're indoctrinated and you're put into a situation, you're not making individual choices. If you're the average soldier, you do what you're told to do. And we redeem them from any sense of personal liability as long as they're doing it under command. And that's why it's rare, with all the killing we do and all the unnecessary deaths we bring upon the world, that you ever hear that anybody in America went to jail for it. Policymakers, generals, politicians who support it, like McCain and Lindsey Graham and these other people, or presidents like Obama, and soldiers. And the only ones who are ultimately sacrificed, if there is ever a problem, are the soldiers. So now what happens? Do they go through 3 months of boot camp when they get out of the armed services to bring back their sense of compassion, bring back their sense of morality, bring back their sense of humanistic values? Not at all. So what's supposed to happen when you have not been reconditioned to reenter society with some of the values that you had at one point? Then you're not going to see any demonstration in the streets or anywhere else as people who deserve respect. They're a threat, and you're the attack dog. So if you think in any naive way that somehow when it starts to go bad, which it will, when you have a class war, which we have, in the next couple of years, when the police state overextends and the inequality is so great and an environmental destruction so severe and economic standards so warped against the poor and middle class that we return to debtors' prisons with a passion, all supported by our current, you know, capitalist, neoliberal society, do you really think any soldier is ever going to stop and say, we shouldn't be doing this? So just remember, when it comes, the police, the National Guard, those who've served, those who are in the armed forces, those in special forces, those who are guiding them, the national intelligence agencies that are behind them, These are not people evolved in spiritual notions. They do not respect life, except their own. Just a thought. And finally, I wanted to share I want to share the Thomas Paine, because I believe today we need Thomas Paine. More than ever, we need Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine was born in 1737 in Thetford, Norfolk, which is in England, and his father was a manufacturer of rope stays used on ships. And after attending grammar school, Paine was apprenticed to his father, and later he held a variety of positions in England, including an excise officer and a school teacher. Now, Paine also opened a tobacco shop, but it went broke, and the resulting financial difficulties put Paine in danger of debtors' prisons. We have that today, don't we? Even though it was outlawed in the 1800s, we now have it back today. But he was saved from ending up a life in debtors' prisons by Benjamin Franklin, to whom he had been introduced by a fellow excise officer. And Franklin suggested to Paine that he should immigrate to America, so he set sail in 1774. But Thomas Paine barely survived the voyage to America. Why? Because the water on board had been polluted with typhoid fever, and when the ship arrived in Pennsylvania, Paine was so ill that he had to be carried ashore. In fact, it was Benjamin Franklin's personal physician who nursed Thomas Paine back to health. Paine then moved to Pennsylvania, and in 1775, he found work as editor of the Pennsylvania Magazine, and that's where he really dug in. Now, most of the people listening right now, at least those of you who are baby boomers, you heard of or hopefully read Common Sense. Paine wrote it in 1776, and he became a very positive and enthusiastic advocate for American independence. Now, he published this. It was a pamphlet, not a book, Common Sense. But here's what you may not know. It sold over 500,000 copies. Now, you'd say, well, okay, that's a good-selling book. No, that's the biggest-selling book in American history per population. There were only 2.5 million Americans. So in proportion to the total population, the pamphlet by Paine sold more copies than any printed work ever published in America before or since. And besides readers who owned copies of Common Sense, back then you didn't have the internet, you didn't have television, you didn't have cell phones, you didn't have television. So what you did have is you had common home readings. You even had readings in taverns. So people would get up and read different things that they felt were important. So the revolution against the English monarchy had already started. But Paine's pamphlet encouraged enlistment in George Washington's Continental Army, and it supplied the colonists with strong arguments for independence. They needed a rallying cry. And that's why today we can say that Thomas Paine was the father of the American Revolution, not George Washington. It was Thomas Paine. But let's be more specific. In his introduction to Common Sense, Paine wrote, quote, "The cause of America is, to a great extent, the cause of all mankind. Many circumstances have and will arise, which are not local but universal, and through which principles all lovers of mankind are affected, and in the event of which their affectations are interested. The laying of a country desolate, with fire and sword, declaring war against the natural rights of all mankind and the defenders thereof from the face of the earth, is the concern of every man to whom nature hath given the power of feeling, of which class, regardless of party censure, is the author." That's very powerful. That shows someone who is very similar to Thoreau. Remember, it was Thoreau who said, you cannot be both a good citizen and a good person. You have to choose which. Why? Because frequently when we say we're a citizen, we then start looking at our citizenship as if it was a nativist or a nationalist. So you believe in America, right or wrong. You're for or against us. What if you're wrong? Well, then you can't be on our side. You're the enemy, the other. So we become highly intolerant to anyone who holds a view different than our own. Do we have the patience to listen to view? Or the very conditioning by which we go through the media and the pundits, already sets what our beliefs should be. Think of the axis of evil. They made Gaddafi And Saddam Hussein and the other people that they wanted to attack, first comparing them to Hitler and made them seem like evil, the axis of evil. Did we have any background? Did we have any knowledge of these people or their country or their government? No. We simply went with what we were told. Well, were the people telling us objective? No. Did they meet with these people and examine something before they predicted the outcome of what would happen if we went against them? Nope. They were all simply giving opinions given to them by other people who had opinions from down. And so everybody passed an opinion forward. And as they passed it forward, it became more codified, more absolute. We must invade for peace, democracy, and freedom. And then you look back now and say, okay, for all the people who thought that power and the class power, those who had the power in America are always those who are the wealthiest. For those of you who are wealthy and you decided which countries to go into, and you decided there was something about that country, maybe it's natural resources, maybe it's minerals, or it's oil, or it's gas, or water, or timber, but you needed that. Maybe it was ideological. Maybe it was geopolitical. But you suddenly had your opinion valued more than someone else. That's the danger of not respecting all voices. That's the danger of any society that has a small group of dilettantes, like the editors and people at the New York Times, the Washington Post, a billionaire who owns the Washington Post, or the clowns over at CNN. And they should dress up in clown outfits before go to their work each day. That's how they would actually look better going on the news. And if they were dressed like a clown and say, don't believe anything I say because I'm just a clown for hire, then we could say, fine, I won't believe anything you say. But unfortunately, these people take themselves seriously, and we take them even more seriously, because they're a stamped, monikered brand, the brand of freedom. America's exceptional. We provide freedom. Well, that's not true. We've caused 20 million people to die in the world who didn't need to in the last 55 years. And we shouldn't have. But how often did anyone hold those people accountable? So that's why Thomas Paine is so important, because he reminded people of what it meant to have common sense and what it meant to use it, and what it meant to come together and look at a country that could not be great as long as it was merely an appendage of Great Britain. And we didn't need their constitution. We didn't need their we didn't need their royalty. We didn't believe that a person who is elected to head should be there for life and be entitled to make unilateral decisions. We believed that it should be representative of the people, that at one person, one vote. So the person you vote for is your employee. We, the people, we pay for them. Now look at it today. These are dictators. Dictators without any common sense, reason, compassion, sensibility, historical notions. They're clueless about everything. They haven't the slightest idea of what's going on in the world. They simply walk around dictating, writing executive orders. But all the people around them are aware of this, the technocrats, the people who are there as messengers of the autocrats. Remember, all these clowns in Washington, all of them are there at the behest of others. The lobbyists, the contractors, the lawyers, these are all pimps, all of them. I make no exception, because they're not there to serve your interests. They do not seek your counsel. They do not seek your advice. They do not seek your opinion. They tell you what you should think and how you should think and how you should reason. They tell you what you should think when after they have invaded a country that represented no threat to the United States, like Libya, and you decimate it and you kill tens of thousands of people, men, women, and children. You waylay to a country, the most prosperous country, in all of in all of Africa, 54 nations in Africa. It was the most prosperous, longest lived, the best, most rights for women of any country, Muslim country in the world. And you destroy the entire country on the false pretense that they had attacked their own citizens, which proved not to be true. They were there to defend the country from United States, Great Britain. Boy, is that a blowback that they just experienced happening. But do we care about this? No, we do not. You see, I have found an irony in life. We can only honor one truth at a time, and only one dominant truth at a time. So if we are committing ourselves to the destruction of a people in the name of freedom, peace, and democracy, we cannot then go and look at the charred remains of that village, of those decapitated kids from bombs that we, or missiles that we exploded. We will keep it at what it costs to keep this going and who's joining us and who's assisting us in this genocide. The media must always honor those who are empowered to be policymakers, and therefore they will put the best spin on it. They'll talk about, wow, this is an exciting new plane. Look at that bomb that it's carrying. It's a brand new type of bomb, brand new type of nuclear missile. You know, this one is more specific. It'll hit a target and cause damage only within a 10-mile area, which might kill a million people, but it's better than the old-time bombs. They'll never ask, have you been there? Have you spoken with these people? Have you looked at what else we could do to prevent this massacre? And the answer is never. These are propagandists. These journalists, they are a disgrace to journalism. And when they come back and tell the truth, like Chris Hedges and others, John Pilger, and then they will not participate in this, and they leave those venues and share their voices elsewhere. That's what Thomas Paine was telling us. So in the main body of the pamphlet, he opposed the idea of the English Constitution. He said, quote, "I know that it is difficult to get over long-standing prejudices, yet if we suffer ourselves to examine the component parts of the English Constitution, we shall find them to be the base remains of two ancient tyrannies compounded with some new republican materials. First, the remains of monarchical, tyrannical people in the person of the king. Secondly, the remains of the aristocracy and the tyranny in the persons of the peers. Thirdly, the new republican materials in the persons of the commons, on whose virtue depends the freedom of England. There is something exceedingly ridiculous in the composition of monarchy. It first excludes a man from the means of information, yet empowers him to act in cases where the highest judgment is required. The state of a king shuts him off from the world, yet the business of a king requires him to know it thoroughly, whereof the different parts, by opposing and destroying each other, prove the whole character to be absurd and useless. That the crown is the overbearing part of the English Constitution needs not be mentioned, and that it derives its whole consequence merely from being the giver of places and pensions is self-evident, whereof, although we have been wise enough to shut a lock on a door against absolute monarchy, we are at the same time foolish enough to put the crown in possession of the key," end quote. So the Continental Congress sought financial help from France to support the Revolutionary War against England. And Thomas Paine was sent to France as only, by the way, one of two negotiators. He landed there in March 1781 and returned to America in August with 2.5 million silver as part of a 6 million of a loan. And Paine returned to England in 1787. And what was interesting, he soon became involved in a debate concerning the French Revolution. And in 1790, the conservative writer Edwin Burke issued a pamphlet called Reflections on the Revolution in France. And Burke's pamphlet was an argument for retaining traditional methods of government, since they had evolved slowly and had been tested over the long periods of time. Well, Burke argued traditional forms of government, there's your born-again Christians, and there's your traditionalists in the Democrat and Republican Party, and there's your Blue Dog Democrats. We need the Democratic Party. No, we need the Republican Party. We need the church. We need, you know, religion in our government. And people believe that. That's the conditioning. That's the epigenetic conditioning, where people can no longer have common sense and reason and truth because they're reacting. It's all reflective and reactive. And that's what Thomas Paine was saying. So Burke's pamphlet provoked a storm of refutations, and Thomas Paine joined the chorus with a pamphlet entitled The Rights of Man. Now, I don't know if you've read The Rights of Man. He first offered his pamphlet to a liberal publisher, Joseph Johnson. However, Johnson had been warned by government agents that if he printed anything by Thomas Paine, he'd be speedily imprisoned. So Paine himself was warned by William Blake, I'm sure you've heard of William Blake, that if he returned to his lodgings, he too would be in prison and be hanged. So Blake said, "Friend, leave, go to France." And so before leaving for France, Paine entrusted the rights of man to another printer, J.S. Jordan, who risked arrest by publishing it, and nearly a half million copies were sold. And in England, Thomas Paine was tried in absentia for writing The Rights of Man, and he was convicted. You might consider Thomas Paine in England like Malcolm X in the United States. He was not the standard bearer of the civil rights movement. He was a bearer of the truth against the insidious nature of racism and why it had to be challenged in a different way. And so Paine was convicted and of seditious libel against the king, and he was going to be hanged, but he had already gone off to France. But here's the interesting part. When Paine was in France, he couldn't speak French. He wasn't a citizen of France, and yet the French National Convention was so respectful of him, what he had done with his Common Sense and the Rights of Man, that they elected him to the French National Convention. And so for a period of time, he was in France. But then in 1793, Robespierre arrested Thomas Paine because he supported a rival. And if it were not for an intervention, Thomas Paine would have been guillotined in France under Robespierre. Robespierre was such a clown, such a dilettante idiot, that in the end, all of Robespierre's comrades were executed, including Robespierre. I guess when you are that detached from reality and you have no one else to kill, you end up killing yourself. But that was a mess. But Thomas Paine almost became a victim of that. People are not generally aware of that. So he got back, and the reason that he was spared was because a diplomat who would be our former president, James Monroe, intervened and got him out of France. So if you haven't read the book, The Rights of Man, about human rights originate in nature, thus rights cannot be granted via political charter, because that implies that rights are legally revocable, hence would be privileges. Now consider that. Consider the wisdom in that. He says, quote, "It is a perversion of terms to say that a charter gives rights. It operates by a contract effect, that of taking away rights. Rights are inherently in all the inhabitants, but charters are annulling those rights. In the majority, leave the right by exclusion in the hands of a few. They consequently are instruments of injustice." Now, what does that mean? To me, that means that corporations are corporations because they have a charter. And that's why when you see corporate people creating drugs that kill people, knowingly creating drugs that are going to kill people, but they like Vioxx, and they make $12 billion net profit even after paying for all their legal fees. Well, you just made $12 million for killing 100,000 Americans, and you don't go to jail. You can't be arrested personally. And you get to keep your charter. You give a fee to the government, and you give a fee to this persons who are injured or killed. And so tens of thousands of corporations regularly break the law. Every single pharmaceutical company I researched had broken the law thousands of times or paid thousands of lawsuits, and the same on Wall Street. So we have these chronic offenders of the law, but they're protected by charter, and they lobby for those charters. So why not do what Thomas Paine would suggest? If you break the law, you should have no charter that protects you. And you having a charter should not be able to amend my rights as a human being. Who are you to tell me what I should do as a citizen? The government shouldn't be lording over me. The government should be suppressing me. I shouldn't fear my government. I shouldn't live just to pay the taxes for the government to spend through its worthless and corrupt bureaucracies and the contractors smart enough to be a part of it and the former politicians and laborers within that government who exploit their position of power in order to profit from being in there, all at the cost and all on the backs of the working class that they have abandoned. So I've always believed that we should revoke all charters of any corporation found guilty of malice aforethought, intentionally doing something that destroyed the quality of life. Then watch how quickly if those board of directors, officers, could be held personally accountable and go to jail, and the corporation could not pay their fines, they would have to pay them themselves, what a difference it would make. Well, that's the way it is. By the way, Abraham Lincoln's writing style was very much influenced by Paine's, and so was Thomas Edison. He was a great believer. And Jose Gervasio Artigas was also a big advocate, and he wrote his Instructions of 1813 based upon Paine's work. So Benjamin Franklin was a great follower of his. In fact, we know Franklin was a great inventor, and he was, but Thomas Paine also invented the single-span iron bridges that he designed that have been constructed in many parts of the world today. And he also contributed to the improvement of the steam engine. At least the people in Great Britain appreciate Thomas Paine. He was voted number 34 out of 100 greatest Britons in a public poll conducted by the BBC. And we want to thank John Avery for his contributions. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.